something to me. Well, tell him I say fuck.
Welcome to The Streets Are Planning. This is your host, Jay Ruffin, and I am so happy to be with you today, man. It is a beautiful day in the city. You know, we got a great guest here. I'm going to give him a minute to introduce himself properly, but I just got to say I'm so excited to have, you know, this guest on the show, man. It's somebody that I've admired for quite some time. We've had an opportunity to kind of work together a little bit when we were in grad school, man, doing some really high quality work that, you know, I still to this day, man, is some of the best experiences that I've had working in the community and working with students and providing skills. And so he's carried that work on, man. And he's been, you know, taking the planning world and the GIS world by storm. I know folks, when you hear the name and when you hear his story, it's going to resonate with you because it's important that we lift up folks who are about community and about the work that you know, this guest is definitely about that life. So Frank Romo, I want to thank you. I appreciate you for being on the show of Romo GIS, you know, his owned and operated fully business. And, you know, he's doing some major, major work. But Frank, you know, one of the big things that we do here when we start the show is always like, you know, the where I'm from piece, you know, that's the where I'm from segment. So we'll give you an opportunity to introduce yourself, talk about where you're from, and then we're going to get into how you got to where you are so far, man. So Frank, go ahead.
Hey, man, thank you very much for having me. I think it's just a real honor to be here, and I appreciate the kind words and right back at you. You know, it's been great doing the work that we've done together where we met, you know, helping community members, helping our community, helping educate folks, and I love doing it. My name is Frank Romo. I'm from Los Angeles, from L.A.California. That's a shout out to MERS. You know,
yes, sir.
Hey, so I'm from Cali, love Cali. That's where my family is. Family born and raised East LA, and you know, it's great out there. Learned a lot about planning real quick, learned a lot about segregation real quick, learned a lot about how the world works very quickly out there. And you know, that was what got me into community organizing back in LA. Did a lot of community organizing in South Central and East LA, did work around food deserts, did work around labor organizing, getting people access to better health care and wages and rights. And you know, that's really where my heart is, trying to help you know, all of our communities come together to overcome and create better and safer neighborhoods and, you know, make sure that they're getting access to the capital they need to improve their neighborhoods and live a life that is suitable for their families. So for me, labor organizing and, you know, the fight against capitalism is something that's really important because that's what I think is one of the key things that holds a lot of our communities down. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. Then from there, went off to Columbia University, where I studied there for a year. It was a study abroad program in New York and Paris, did some architecture work there. But one of the key things there was I got right involved in the community again because that was when Hurricane Sandy happened when I was in New York. And that's when I first got introduced to GIS or geographic information systems. And in using geographic information systems or mapping technology, we actually went down to Red Hook, Brooklyn and surveyed the damage. We worked with community members to knock door to door, see who needed what, where the damages were. And that was the first time I saw the power of tech and community combined to make a real impact. And so, you know, I had the community background from LA. I got some of the tech skills in New York. And then after that, I went to University of Michigan to get my master's degree. And then from there, that's where I founded my company. And since then, you know, it's been a real great ride. Company's been growing very, very much. A lot of new projects, a lot of different projects, but one thing stays the same. Every project that we work on is focused on helping community members support organizations that are doing work, whether that be in advocacy for prison reform, advocacy for access to better healthcare, advocacy for heat stress or environmental hazards, things like that, whatever it is. And that's why I like GIS and the technologies that I use, because whatever the dilemma is, if we have add a little bit of organizing techniques, add a little bit of technology, add a little bit of community input and community leadership, all of a sudden we got a transformational program, transformational organization, transformational group that's trying to make a difference. So that's kind of where I come from, got educated like that. Once that was done, started my own my own GIS program where we teach and educate minority students, try to get them on the track to getting access to tech skills. And since then, I've been doing work for the city of Detroit. And out here in the city of Detroit, I also do a little bit of real estate development, try to, you know, kind of bolster the community here, because I think for anybody who wants to be an urbanist or make an impact in their community, we got to recognize that it's every aspect, from transportation to health to safety. We got to hit all of those things. And, you know, doesn't mean we have to be experts at all those things, but we got to know how to bring the people together and organize around those things.
Yo, man. And that, I mean, that's really important too. This is one of the things that I love about, you know, my, about this show. And when we have guests on, is that for folks to understand, you know, the where people are coming from, man, like what brought you to this, to be an urbanist, to be in this field, you know, urban planning, architecture, real estate development, all of these things. And it's always interesting for me, because, you know, I know my guests in a different way sometimes. Some I know really well, some I don't. But having known you for a number of years and having worked with you, it's one of those things where it's like, man, the story, it just resonates with me so much, because what you've done is what I think great planners, great architects, great urbanists do, which is take that lived experience, bring it to the table with their actionable experience, things that they've done that they may have been involved in prior to their career in architecture, urban planning, engineering, whatever. And still, you know, when they get to a certain level, it's always about giving that service back. So I got to ask you, I mean, with the work and the space that you're in, why do you think it's important, or why is it important for you to make sure that you're giving back to Black and Brown communities across the country with the work that you do?
I think one of the main things that I try to hold on to is that, you know, education and knowledge is transformational. And I think it could be as small as teaching somebody how to push a few buttons on a GIS machine, or it could be as thought-provoking and as in-depth as trying to teach folks how to think more critically about their communities and think more critically about the hierarchies and the structures that are imposing upon their neighborhoods and their families. And I think, you know, it's important to recognize that if we can provide students, mothers, fathers, aunts and uncles, community members, people, if we could provide people with the language and the tools and the opportunities to make that impact and to make a difference, they will do it and they will step up. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the thing about Brown and Black communities is that community and family are really important. Community and family are central, and we need to harness those connections and those networks for good. I mean, any social movement that you've seen in the past, from the 1960s before all the way up through, you know, what we've seen through 2020 with the Black Lives Matter movement, it's all around connections, network, community. And I think that's where I really see the opportunity in tech, because the tech has the ability to break down barriers even further. I think at first there can be barriers because there's a digital divide, because people don't have access. But that is part of the plan, right? Not giving you access to the tools so you don't have access to power is what exactly the dominant group in power wants. So if we can break down those barriers, allow people to get more access to resources, to technical education, to helping them understand more critically about how to impact their local neighborhood through different petitions, activism, organizing. If we can harness those connections, you know, we're all out here doing it for one another. And I think that's what it comes down to. You know, we're all out here trying to support one another. And somebody gave me the opportunity. Somebody helped me get here. And so, you know, we just got to pay that forward, because that's what we've been taught to do, because that's our community and that's our centerpiece. You know, I always think about my mom and my grandma telling me in the back of my mind, what are you doing to help somebody else? You know, what are you doing to try to bring somebody else up? And I know a lot of us were raised that way. And that's what we got to be infusing back into the community, not just to our neighbor, not just on a personal aspect, but in our professional capacity too.
And so I appreciate that answer sincerely, man. I think, you know, the piece that, you know, that comes to mind for me is this GIS and the innovation around it is something that is extremely exciting to me. I think, you know, and seeing your work and how you've applied it, and the research that you've applied it to, it's like, man, this is something that's been necessary and needed for a very long time. And so for you, before we hop into kind of what it is and how you've been utilizing the GIS, I really, you know, you touched on it a little bit, but I really want to to kind of hear a little bit more, which is why GIS for you? Why, I mean, why has that been the focus for your practice and for what it is that you felt like, look, man, I want to get in this space, and this is where I'm going to go ahead and push forward and grow and expand and utilize it to bring community together.
I'm an organizer when it comes down to it. And it's about power, man. It's always about power. And I think GIS is about access to data, access to information that is trying to articulate what our world looks like. You know, it's maybe a bunch of computer screens or ones and zeros or whatever, you know, on a theoretical level. But when it comes down to it, you know, being able to see your community on a map, being able to see what's going on in your neighborhood on a map, or see the, have access to those technologies, it gives you more power. It gives you more power to shape your community, helps you understand your community better. And I think for me, as an organizer, you recognize the tools that are used to keep people down. You recognize the tactics that are used. And we can go, it's a very popular conversation now. And, you know, it used to just be in the planning realm about redlining and about not lending to certain neighborhoods. I mean, that's how, that's why we were doing work in South LA and East LA on food deserts, because, you know, folks didn't want to invest in there. And they said, hey, we're specifically drawing a line on the map and we're not going to invest in this neighborhood. And so when you see that those are tools that have been used for decades to, when you see that those are tools that have been used for decades to diminish our communities and to not give our communities access to resources or equal access to basic goods and services, you got to ask yourself, how come we're not using that tool and using it in a different way? And so for me, it's about having access to that data and having access to those tools. Like I said before, I think it's about power, and keeping it out of the public's hands is the best thing that those in power want. So by me organizing and talking and trying to share that information with folks, it's me trying to spread the power and spread the knowledge, because all it takes is one little light bulb here, one little light bulb there, one little light bulb there. All of a sudden you got 10, 5, 15 people who are real angry about why the hell is this going on in my community. And I have the proof to back it up, because to your point, everybody knows the lived experience. Everybody knows you got to walk 30 minutes to go to the grocery store. Everybody knows the bus ain't coming. Everybody knows that. But with GIS, we're able to put that on a map and be able to use that as a data point, as a way to say, hey, look, you can't lie to this. You may be able to diminish my story. You may be able to tell me that I'm crazy, that I don't have this, I'm this way, whatever the rhetoric may be at that moment, to try to put down our community or my personal experience. But when you bring out that data, when you bring out those maps, you know, there's no line, there's no denying that.
Without question, man. And it goes to the line, one of the great lines from Jay-Z, you know, that he would say, man, he's like, men lie, women lie, numbers don't, man. And I think, you know, we know numbers can be manipulated and all those different types of things. So it ain't completely 100% accurate. But the data that you have and the data sets that you're bringing to the table, you know, clean data that's being utilized for a very powerful movement and a necessary movement that we have in the country, you can see that data and it becomes a visual tool in all the ways that you just explained. And that power, highlighting the power disparities and highlighting the opportunities to be able to get in and for folks on the ground that are activists and that are, you know, community organizers like we've been in our lives is extremely important to provide that tool for them, man. So I tip my hat to you. And I just want to let you know the now we're going to get into this conversation about that, how you've been applying that work, because there's a lot of movements that have been going on, but I think this movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, has had, this escalation in awareness and an escalation in people understanding what the movement is about. And I think the data and the things that you are presenting allows for that to continue to flourish. And continue to be at the forefront of what folks need to be talking about when we're talking about policy change and we're talking about community change and the quality of life improvements that are needed in Black communities and Black and brown communities across the country. So, you know, the piece that if for those of you can find it in the show notes, I'm going to have links here to some of Frank's research and the work that he's been engaged in for a number of years. But the map in the Black Lives Matter movement is one of those things that I was like, man, this is extremely brilliant, man. I mean, to see how this work has been done, to where protests have taken place, to where there's, you know, Black Lives Matter art pieces and contested statues and all that stuff. Like, this is a real deal tool that I've been messing around and playing with a little bit. And I'm like, yo, this is amazing, because it's not just about work in a particular area. Like, you're highlighting this stuff across the globe of where these things have been taking place. And so kind of tell me how you got started with this particular work here. And, you know, and then we'll talk about how it's progressed and where you've gone.
Woo, man, this work, it's real close to my heart. And, you know, we saw obviously everything that's gone on in 2020, George Floyd's death and the outrage and the anger and the organization that took place thereafter to speak out, not only against his death, but the countless number of other deaths that we have seen and the ones that have not been seen or publicized even, you know. And I think for me, I just want to take a step back, is that I've always done work around policing because it's something that's really important to me. Because again, being from LA, oh, you know, you're a target. Oh, you know, when you're riding in your car or when you're walking on the street, you better not put your hood on, better not jaywalk. You know, you just know these things inherently. And, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of us who got to live that way. And that's the reality of the situation, especially in urban centers where there are massive amounts of police and there is over policing of certain neighborhoods, poor communities, et cetera. So again, like, to your point from before, this comes directly from lived experience. So this is something that's so close to my heart because I've spoke out about it before. I've been at the demonstrations. I've organized. I've trained organizers how to train people how to know their rights. So you don't have a search warrant. You can't search my car. You know, you're not allowed to come in. Even as we go talking about, you know, with regards to like immigration or things like ICE and stuff like that, and people need to know their rights. And I think that's something that when I focus on education, that's something that is really important to me, because that's, again, that knowledge is power and it helps give protection. And this is something that has been very important to me for a long time, this type of research. So when it first got started, you know, we saw the protests popping up in New York and Chicago and Minneapolis and LA. And it was really interesting to me because, you know, it was like I followed it every single night, you know, and because we were on the East Coast, all my family and all my people are on the West Coast. And so I was staying up to like 3 a.m. over here because stuff was just getting started over in LA, like midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And so, you know, it was really interesting when it first started happening, because I started to map it right away and it started to light up like a Christmas tree. It was like, okay, New York, Chicago, urban centers. And it started to, as the day went on, it was quite remarkable. You would start to see them pop up across the nation as the time zones changed. People got off work and then it was 6 o'clock, then it was 7 o'clock. And then stuff started to get really crazy when the sun went down, because then the eyes are no longer on the police and they think they have more leeway. And, you know, it's the same playbook everywhere you look. And so I seen it before. I knew what was coming, saw the, you know, okay, they're coming with they're coming with the National Guard. They're coming with the martial law at some point. You know, you can see the tactics from a mile away. It's 101. And when I saw that, I was reminded of Trayvon's death. I was reminded of different individuals, Philando Castile, different just across the board. But again, because this is research that I've been doing for a long time. And, you know, it always hits me, but at the same time, it always frustrates me because I'm like, okay, when are we going to do something? When are we going to do something? And I've been out there, I've trained the folks, I've marched, I've done those things. And this time it just felt different. And again, for me as an organizer, from being there, I felt it in my bones and I was like, this is different. Something is happening this time. And so I said, all right, we got to get to work. So I got my team and we started to scrape data from all over the news sites, all over the US Weekly, US News, everywhere we could. And we started to create a mapping infrastructure. So we put a map, put a point on the map. We put a link to a report of that protest from a local news affiliate so we can get our sources right. Because one of the things that's really important is that when you're doing this kind of work that is contrary to the hegemonic belief or whatever folks, you know, in power want to others, the rest of the media to believe, it's really important that you have your sources. It's really important that you have your T's crossed and your I's dotted, because those are the first things they're going to come for to try to undermine your research and try to undermine your efforts. And so we made sure we put all the points on the map. We linked to local news sources, and then we started to get pictures of the protest while still simultaneously remembering, like, hey, we can't be having people's images in here too much, because it could, you know, we want to help the community. We don't want to put the community at a disadvantage by the work that we're doing. So that's always a fine line too, because you have to really be in check with what you're doing. So as the time began to progress, you know, May came around, June came around, we started to add more and more to the map. And then we started to see stuff pop off globally, you know, in the UK, in Australia. And that's when I was really going a little cuckoo. It was like 4 a.m. I'm like tweeting with people in Australia, trying to talk to folks over there, like, what's going on over there? So,
yeah, I've been in that position, man. You're trying to tweet with folks on the other side of the world, bro. You'd be in a rabbit hole, man.
Yeah. So I was, you know, it was just trying to collect all that data. We put it on a spreadsheet. We mapped it. And then I had every one of my analysts, somebody entered it and somebody quality checked it. Somebody made sure that that was the right location, that link worked. So then we finally started to launch the map. We first launched the map with just the protest locations. I think when we first launched it, we had, you know, over probably about 200, 250 locations. And that was just within the first week or so. And then then we had the statues getting contested, and then there was artwork popping up all over. And that's where myself as an organizer, I say, well, we can't just talk about the demonstrations and the protests. The art, the taking back of this public space, that's also part of this movement. That's also part of us trying to take power back, right? A movement has many forms, and everybody has their own role. And those artists play just as key of a role as those organizers. And those organizers take just as a key role as people calling on the phones. It takes everybody, right? It takes that village to go make this happen. So we started, so I kind of employed that in my own work too. You know, I had my mom or my cousin or somebody was like, hey, can you check this data? Can you help me? Because, you know, I was a little short-handed. I was like, hey, all hands on deck, man. And, you know, that's the great part about it, going back to that community aspect. People were like, yo, this is important. I'm here. You know, this is important. I'm here to show up. And, you know, that's what we do. We show up and we try to bring our best selves. And we did that. We put the work out there. And then we started to say, all right, how can we enhance this? So then we created a crowdsourcing kind of application to it, where we allowed folks to drop points on the map if they were at a protest. We allowed them to submit their pictures if they were at a protest. We allowed them to say, hey, this isn't on the map. We should add it to the map. Then we verified it, cross-referenced it, put it on the map. Needless to say, when it was all said and done, we had over 5,000 protests on the map worldwide, you know, over 200 pieces of artwork categorized, and, you know, over 80 or some so contested statue locations. And it wasn't just to do it to showcase and say, oh, look, this was a great project. It, for me, again, I started to realize, okay, I play a different role now. You know, I used to be in the streets. I used to be organizing and training, but my role is a little different now. And in this role, I have to create the narrative that we want to see out there, because, you know, the media will change it, will skew it. And one of the things I wanted to do by creating that map was try to help the narrative and say, you know, look, this is all going on everywhere, and they're majority peaceful. There's been research from research organizations, nonprofits, organizations not affiliated with any part of the movement who have stated, you know, it was only violent at X amount of protests, and that may have been perpetrated by law enforcement even. And so, you know, there's that research that's coming out now. So what I like to see is our research being able to be used as a base for that. That's really great. So we contribute in that way. But also, you know, for me, it's really important. I think maybe nostalgia is not the right word, but some kind of ethos where you connect to a project or connect to a narrative or connect to a moment in time. I think a lot of us organizers really look to the 1960s for that beforehand. And we, you know, we look to that. We look to MLK. We look to Malcolm X. We look to folks, you know, marching on Washington. And we said, look at that moment. That was amazing. What if I could be there? And, you know, now you can be there. You are still there. We are still there. But make no mistake about it, we are still there. And we still need people to show up. And I think in doing so, I played a different role. And by producing that application, I not only help educate folks who maybe were at the fringes who didn't know about it, right? There's that small education piece, there are the folks who are in it who say, hey, I want to contribute and add more data. Then there are other folks who say, hey, this is a really cool app. Can we show it to our organization? And can we add some points to the map? That's great. And then there's another organization that says, hey, can you teach us how to do this? And now we're talking, because now we're reaching people at different levels. We're reaching people at different levels of education and understanding. And as an organizer, you're always taught, you got to meet people where they are. You got to come to them and try to support them where they are with the tools that they have. So for me, one of the biggest parts about the project was that it created an archive, if you call it that, you know, a living archive, because another thing I know, the media propaganda machine, you know, 15 years later, all I kept telling myself, I said, I have to catalog this right now, because in 15 years, they're going to redact this. They're going to throw this in the trash. They're going to make sure this link doesn't work. And that's part of erasing our history. That's part of erasing the power that we've taken back. And if we don't have a way to capture that, celebrate that, and say, look, we did this, then, you know, we're screaming into the void. And I think in providing that map, you know, that just that visual that says, oh, damn, like this really happened. There's a sense of pride. There's a sense of, oh, wow, we really were out there marching. We were trying to take this to the streets and try to make sure that the government listens to us and hears us. It's remarkable the amount of power that has, because all it takes is somebody to see their point on a map, see their house on a map, see their city on a map. Because whenever somebody's on a map, a digital map, the first place they zoom in is their home, and they want to see what's going on near their home, right? Everybody wants to know what's going on locally. And so when you see your point on the map and you see that, you're like, oh, wow, my people showed out. We showed up and we were trying to help and support in any way we could. And I think that was one of the biggest parts of me trying to contribute, is to create that archive and to help empower and inspire future leaders.
Man, and I think you definitely, with this tool that you and your team and the folks that you were working with, like the work and the love and the passion that you put in definitely shows. And so folks who are listening, you definitely click on these links, make sure you go and look at this data, the GIS for social good, the mapping the Black Lives Matter movement. Like all of this stuff is like going to be in the links that we're going to share with you, because I want folks to follow up, because that the piece that you spoke about that also resonated with me was showing the power of a movement visually. And I think for a lot of people, when they hear Black Lives Matter and they think about this, they think about, you know, Minneapolis because of the murder of George Floyd and the protests and things that took place there. Los Angeles, of course, they think Detroit, they think New York, Miami, all of these places. But the power of this movement being international and seeing how it's taking place in, like, say, London or Sweden, or seeing that there were protests in North Dakota and Wyoming and all of these places that you would not consider to be, you know, like places where protests happen for Black and brown folks, right? Like it's for Black folks in particular. You're talking about North Dakota, South Dakota. I know like maybe two people that are Black that have lived there. You know what I'm saying? And so to know that these things are happening, it shows the power of this movement and that folks are not alone. And that the beauty of matching this mapping piece with the technology side, you know, of social media and everything else is that feeling in that sense that, you know, a lot of us had last year with COVID being locked in our houses, that we were alone, but we weren't, right? And having a map to show like, oh, there's a protest happened here, a protest happened there. Why can't I do one here in my small community to raise my voice and be a part of this movement for the change of not just the, you know, my community, but the change of the entire country that needs to happen. And it should have happened years ago. But to be a part of that movement now, it's that not on my watch type situation. And I think that's where a lot of folks are at. And hearing you say that is like, hearing you say the importance to this work for you individually, but then also culturally, it's like, bro, there's nothing like looking around and seeing like, oh, we showed up, we here. That gives you a sense of comfort that you're moving in the right way and that you're not alone. And that's what we need, whether it's on a social media platform, you know, rallying with Twitter, but then showing up in person to these protests and making our voices heard is exactly what's needed in order for us to have change. Now, this is a question that that I'll ask because I'm really curious about it, which is this transition from community organizer and understanding the role that you have evolved into. Like, bro, I think that is an underrated, you know, quality that people should have. And you have that, which is like, bro, you realize, all right, I've done the community organizing thing. Where else can I grow and be more effective for the movement? So can you kind of speak to that a little bit, just like on that transition from like, look, I'm on the front lines, I'm doing this, but I have still skills and talents that I want to deploy in a different way, and then making that change, but still being attached to the work.
Right. I think that's really important. I think to start off, community organizer, you know, what happens when you're a community organizer or you're working at the grassroots level, you know, there's a certain level of education and training and critical thinking. You know, there's a whole conversation about critical race theory going on right now. I'm educated as a Chicano studies major, so Mexican American studies. So, you know, I'm all the way rooted in ethnic studies and a history of our peoples and how we got here and the fight that has been in this country for all people of color. And so recognizing that and being that community organizer, it's real easy to be angry and frustrated and like, man, we need to change this now. We need to burn it down, knock it down. And, you know, I was there and I definitely still have a lot of pieces of that fire burning in me. And I think recognizing that community organizing is just a tool like anything else, like urban planning, like the technology, it's just a tool. And I think for me, it really clicked when we were organizing labor organizing campaign in Los Angeles near the airports, trying to get workers better healthcare, better wages, get them unionized. And, you know, we can organize all day. We can shout and argue, or we can try to get petitions signed. But at the end of the day, there's somebody still who's got to sign the other line on that petition. Somebody who's got a decision maker, a politician, whomever it may be. And there's many stories. Again, LA has no shortage of it, where you've had communities of color get decimated by freeways, by other, you know, infrastructure or what have you. You know, there's a great documentary called The Garden. It's about the South Central farmers and their urban garden. You know, they were urban gardening on half an acre before it was cool 20 years ago. And guess what happened? You know, city came in and said, nah, this ain't happening. It's not on our land, you know. And, you know, just little things like that showcase how one tool is never going to get the job done. We need a comprehensive approach. And if you're going to be organizing, that's great. But we also need somebody on the data side. We also need somebody shaking hands with those politicians. And we also need somebody funding our program. And we also need our major community advocates to be coordinated and educated around these issues. You know, one tool is never going to get it done. So for me, when I saw that there were some shortcomings in the organizing route, I went to urban planning. And urban planning was just a tool as well, another way to affect change in the urban environment. But I'm pretty pessimistic, so I knew urban planning was not the way. I was like, no, I can't do that. That's too tied for me. Like for me, I'm like, I feel like a revolutionary. So I'm like, no, that's too much in the system. But you know, that's not to knock it. I think urban planning has a huge role, but for me, it still felt too removed from the neighborhood, from the community, because it's always from my perspective, from my neighborhood, it's always a lot of lip service. Oh yeah, we're cool. Yeah, you're good. Oh, we hear you, but no, we're going to do what we want anyways.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of those things where it's like having the field be more representative, right, of the culture is so extremely important. And so, you know, I just want to say, I just had to just kind of get that answer from you, man, because I think it's important for people to know that it's okay to transition too, right? I mean, I think as those of us who have been community organizing, I did organizing, you know, myself, affordable housing, voting, organizing, like all of this stuff. And it was like, man, if I'm not right there on the front lines pushing and continuing to do this, then I'm not doing the work. Right. But there is an evolution that is okay to take place. If you maintain the perspective of that your work is going to continue to contribute to positively impact the quality of life of the people from your neighborhood, the people from neighborhoods that look like yours, you know, from people who have experiences similar to what you've had or what you've been advocating for years, then you're still doing the work. You're just doing it in a different way, and you're playing your position. And my thing is that you always have to make sure that we continue to get a respect to the folks who are in the streets and putting themselves in you know, potentially in harm's way in order to provide that voice, because they're without them, you know, the work that we're doing and what we continue to do can't move forward in a positive way.
Absolutely. And I just want to add to that, you know, is that that's exactly what you're exactly right. It's about representation. So for someone like you who has community organized, who has that, you know, critical thinking and critical understanding of how the city works, you are so much more situated to make that impact and bring that to the table. And I think if we look at representation, all of our people of color are the ones out in the streets, knocking on the doors, doing this, doing that. And that's good. And that's not diminish it at all. But we need to try to redistribute our labor and try to see where else we can put folks. You know, if we can put folks in city planning, if we can put folks in the commissioner's office, if we can put folks in the technology office. Now we're talking about a more comprehensive approach and not all of us trying to use the same tool every single time. Because again, you know, those in power figure it out really quickly. And if they don't already have it figured out. And so we need to try to, you know, sneak in the back door sometimes, go through the window, get through the chimney, like get Santa Claus. We're good. We got to figure out how to get through there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the mission is too important to allow one tool to be put out of commission, right? Like you got to have multiple tools in the toolbox to make sure that you can get the job done, because increasing positively the quality of life of folks across the country in neighborhoods that have not had a voice, or neighborhoods and cities that have not had the proper light shined on their condition is important, man. We got to make sure that we're using everything at our disposal to make change happen and make it sustainable. So, you know, the GIS space has been one that again, like I said, I've been very interested in it. And me personally, I don't have the skill set for it, man. Like I tried, that's why I love what you do, because I'm like, that ain't in my wheelhouse. But for those folks who are interested in kind of learning more and maybe, you know, might be interested in just starting out in understanding GIS, are there any, you know, platforms or, you know, software or anything like that that you would recommend folks to just kind of utilize to get familiar with what GIS is and what it can provide?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that our company does at Romo GIS, www.romogis.com, one of the things we do, we provide education to nonprofit organizations. We did a recent curriculum with a local high school here, and we try to use GIS to try to educate whomever to try to make an impact in their community. It could be an individual, it could be a nonprofit, it could be a whole school. It doesn't matter. So we try to offer tools and one-on-one education or workshops to the community to try to advance understanding of GIS and mapping. But to answer your question, you know, GIS is, there's a lot of resources out there on YouTube, on a bunch of places, and there are lots of different tools to get the job done, just like we were talking about. But what I would always advise folks is to test your own spatial thinking first. So I always say, you know, first exercise I have anybody do, no matter if it's a kindergarten student or a master's student, I say, get out a piece of paper and, you know, draw your neighborhood. What does your neighborhood look like to you? Like, and it's interesting because people will draw really large streets. People will draw like the wastewater plant. People will draw the high school. And when you let people do that, it gives you an insight into how they see their community. And that's a really great opportunity to start to have those discussions. Well, why is the water plant here? Why is the wastewater treatment plant here? Why are there no bike lanes? Well, how come there's not a bus nearby, you know? And because if you take somebody from a community of color that is impoverished or has a urban core inner city, you let those group of people draw their neighborhood, and you let somebody from a more affluent or, you know, more segregated kind of planned area draw their neighborhood, it's going to look completely different, and it's going to tell you a lot about what their lives look like. And so all GIS is the representation of your world on a map in the digital space. And so there are lots of tools out there. I'm not going to drop any one of them because I don't want anybody to say I'm supporting specific programs. No, there's a lot of opportunities out there. And if you have any questions, I'm always here to just answer. And, you know, I serve as a mentor for a lot of folks in the GIS industry. So if you ever have any questions, I'm always open. You could give me a ring or an email, and I'm always here to help.
For sure, man. And we will make sure that we include your LinkedIn contact and all that other stuff, because I there's no doubt in my mind that folks are going to be interested in this work and be reaching out to you to learn more and see how they can be trained by you and your team, because the training program that you all have, I mean, I had the opportunity to catch up and witness a training that you just provided to some youth here in the city of Detroit recently. You know, you brought the drones out, you know, you had all kind of cool stuff. You know, they did a like a little, what do you call it? Like one of those like hunts or whatever you call it. Like
they did a little scavenger hunt.
Yeah, scavenger hunt, man. I don't know why I'm flaking on it, but like the scavenger hunt, and to have the kids and see the excitement on their faces of one, they learned a valuable skill. And two, they got to actually apply it during that training. And so, you know, I think that to me, that was just a beautiful thing to see, especially when you see, you know, young black and brown kids that are like operating tools that, you know, are not readily available in our communities all the time. And so to see them, you know, have access to that and have opportunity to learn about it and then apply some of that immediately was like really cool. Can you talk about that a little bit, about that experience and what that was like for you and your team putting that together?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I got to go a little bit back though. Jermaine and I know each other really in depth because we helped do something similar with some folks down in Morehouse. We were working with some folks down there and just taught some basic urban planning stuff, you know, just shoot the shit, just talked about life, talked about the city, talked about what was going on and what we wanted to do to change it. And, you know, again, it's just about giving folks the tools. And so Jermaine and I know each other because, you know, he did his part teaching the urban planning, teaching the a lot of how the city works and how to engage with the city to make change. And I was like, all right, come over here and I'll teach you how to push the buttons. I'll teach you how to do that stuff so you can get those jobs, so you can make that impact. And so that's where Jermaine and I know each other from. So, you know, that mentorship, that education has always been important to me in my business and in just my personal life. And we recently did work with Frederick Douglass Academy for Young Men here in the city of Detroit. And this was a 2-day GIS summer camp. And we had folks come from a lot of different agencies, city of Detroit, OHM advisors, a few different folks, but Romo GIS was leading the charge. You know, I'm the chair of the board there. And we put this program together to try to help students get access to these tools, learn the technology and get them into the pipeline, because the Frederick Douglass Academy for Young Men, I'm really, really proud to say that I'm helping them stand up, you know, the first Pathways program, which is like a very STEM specific program to help students, particularly students of color, get access to GIS in their high school curriculum. So by the time they leave, they're able to potentially get a job right out of high school. And that's the thing, going back to, you know, it's not just about the education. It's about the access to power and capital, because I talked about labor, I talked about capitalism, and this tool, these tools that they're able to use, you know, they pay people lots of money to use these tools. They pay people lots of money to do this work. And so to teach the students a skill that they can translate into financial freedom, a way for upward mobility is one piece, but then also giving them access to show them like, hey, this can actually make a difference in your community too. This, there's just, it's a win-win. And so for me to try to empower them to do those things is really important to me so they can have that opportunity.
Yeah, without question, man. And I think that's extremely important. And I love to see that kind of stuff happening. And I want to see, you know, this type of work happen more often across the country. And so I think, you know, this type of initiative of giving young people skills, not just having them in a summer camp to pass the time by, but to give them an actionable skill that they could employ later on. And like you said, make some money, you know, but also bring change to their respective community, because they also have access to you and your mentorship and the tools and the maps and things that you put together that you can show them that, hey, this is what power looks like. And this is how you can utilize your skill to apply it in the community where you're at. So, you know, salute to you and your team on that, man.
I appreciate it. I just want to say one more thing. I think one of the things that's really important about our model for teaching is that it really replicates that model of organizing. You know, I'm not going to just give you a fish. I got to teach you how to fish. I got to show you how to do it. And then I inspire you and try to educate you and show you that, hey, you're a leader too. You got to go teach two more people now. You got to go teach three more people now. And that's that organizing model. But in doing that in tech, what does that mean? That means that we can have more representation in tech. It means that we can have more representation in those jobs and in those capacities. So I just want to emphasize that because actually starting on Monday, I have one of the high school students who's going to be interning with me.
Oh, man. See, that's what it's about, man. I mean, you know, paying it forward, making sure that you're pulling people up as you go. And, man, I know, listen, I know Romo GIS, man. I'm putting it out there right now. I know you're going to be one of the top companies, you know, in the country and the things that you're doing, you know, because the work is innovative, but the work is culturally relevant. And I think that that's the part where I'm so excited to see where you continue to grow at, because I think culturally relevant work is where we've been lacking as a country and in the world in general. But I think having that, especially in this time after, you know, what we saw last year in 2020 with COVID, what we saw with, you know, the after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and all of these situations, like there's no better time in my mind to have a business like this that promotes this type of data, that promotes this type of access to information, because it can actually be applied to improving the life of people. And so I think in a culturally relevant way and allowing folks to not only just, you know, look at the data, but be able to interact with it and learn how they can, you know, contribute to increasing the relevancy and the amount of data that is that's on the table is just a beautiful thing to see, man. So I just, again, I want to tip my hat to you. But, you know, there's a couple things that I got to salute you on right now, man. Listen, you know, on this show, we always say, like, bro, we give the flowers, man. And this is it's important for me to just acknowledge a couple of things. You know, one thing, man, I just want to say congratulations to you, you know, on your fellowship, you know, the inaugural social justice fellowship with the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Foundation, man. That's a major, major deal. How you feel about that? How do you feel about that that fellowship, man? And when does it start?
The fellowship just started last week. So, yeah, it's their inaugural class of social justice fellows. So they got like 50, 60 folks from across the U.S. who are all, you know, activists and working to make things better. And I was lucky enough to be selected as one of their leaders. And we've already had some great conversations about, you know, how do we make a change? How do we leverage our support from one another? But one of the things that I really admire about the program is that it focuses on mental and personal health as well, because, you know, that's the thing with organizing. It's very tiresome. It's very wearing. And so, you know, when we're doing this hard work, when we're doing this fight, like best believe, you know, I get a question half the time when we talk about the research we're going to get into next about, you know, race and policing. I get questions half the time, like, how do you look at that data of all those people who've been killed, of all this? And, you know, hey, you know, that wears on me. I can act like it doesn't, but it does wear on me to hear those names and to see those points on the map and read those stories as I'm doing that work. And it fuels me to do more work. And it is really important that we have that balance in the mental health side. And so being part of the Memorial Foundation's inaugural class is really exciting to connect with other activists, but also more just to like continue to get better and just continue to refine my tools, bring them to the community and continue to support folks.
Yeah, man. And you know, I wanted to make sure we acknowledge that, man, because it's definitely a huge honor. But, you know, it came at a time where, you know, the research that you were doing. I mean, we touched on, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the work that you did around that. But what you just spoke about, that the race and policing is in the fatal encounters, you know, data that you've been able to gather and like sort through, man, I'm sure from an emotional standpoint and a mental standpoint, man, like seeing that data and knowing that these are real people who lost their lives, you know, senselessly, you know, and were murdered for, you know, just at the hands of people, police who were supposed to protect and serve them, is something that is just, you know, tough to continue to read about on a day-to-day basis, man. So, but the work is important, right? And so I think I think this work in particular is something that, you know, like I said, the cultural relevancy is relevant for this time, but I think that historical context and being able to archive this and say, like, this is really happening, knowing that the police You know, police across the country don't track these numbers. You know, knowing that the FBI just very recently started tracking some of these things, to know that there is an organization such as yourself and your team that's tracking this information, because it's so important to understand where we are in this space, is just really, you know, really important work, man. So you know, before I ask you the question I want to ask you, I want to give a shout out to Harley Etienne.
Yes, necessary all the way.
Necessary, because Harley is, you know, and I think he's a friend and a mentor to both of us, right? It's like we got a lot of love. Harley is a professor at Taubman College at the University of Michigan, a great urban planner, you know, and a great person all around, who really allowed for us to kind of come into our own during our graduate program and supported us in the work that we were trying to do. And I know that he's been, you know, a major partner and research partner and stuff with you on this work. And so I just want to make sure I salute him. Hopefully he's listening, and we want to get you on the show, Harley. So that'll happen here in the near future, man. We got to get some time together. But that work and the research that you all were doing on the fatal police encounters and around like politics and policy and in the GIS space, can you kind of talk to about like how that work came about? And then, you know, where do you see it evolving to and moving forward?
Absolutely. Just to follow up, I agree. Harley Etienne is a great mentor to both of us. And to be fair, he's not only been, you know, the strength and the vision behind part of this project and has been my fellow researcher, but when Jermaine and I were teaching folks down at Morehouse, Harley was there too. So, you know, we all roll together.
Without question.
So, you know, I mean, it just shows you again about showing up, right? We are all there to support one another in our activities and be there to jump on and say, hey, this is important work. Let's go do it. So Harley and I started this research as my master's thesis. It was a small research project looking at a multi-year analysis of people who had been killed by police. And since then, we just wrapped it up in 2020. So that was in 2016. And, you know, we're trying to gather the data, work with some of the historic data like 2013 and 2015. Well, obviously now we're in 2021 and a lot has happened since then. So our most recent data set looks at 2015 to 2020. It's a 5-year span. One of the longer analyses that is out there, you know, and we're trying to really be at the forefront of this because we see that a lot of the organizations like the Washington Post, the Guardian, there's other news organizations who've cataloged how many people have died at the hands of police and law enforcement. But what Harley and I found was that, you know, a lot of times it leaves out some of the most important context, like what does the neighborhood look like? What does the police force look like? How much, you know, what is the neighborhood an impoverished neighborhood that gets over-policed? Is the neighborhood a neighborhood where it has a lot of renters and there's a lot of harassment or things like that from the police? You know, trying to understand in the urban context what this means. So what we did is we researched three or four separate data sets, you know, over the 2015 to 2020 time period. We cleaned them all, brought them all into one clean data set where we could figure out, you know, cross-check and cross-reference. Because to Jermaine's point, you know, there's no real one good data source for this type of information. And, you know, again, from my organizer hat on, if you're the perpetrator and you're telling me you're going to give me the data, I don't trust you worth this. I don't trust you worth nothing.
Exactly. It's like, nah, man, don't give me the information. Let me get it myself so I can feel comfortable with what I'm seeing, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of that has been collected by news organizations. So what we did is we scraped that data, put it together, then we put it on a map, and we did an analysis of each of those data sets individually to see the discrepancies. And even just on their face, you know, you can tell there were different amount of numbers. And one of them had one data set had an incident and another one didn't. And, you know, how do we classify that? How do we quantify that? How do we kind of create a standard of how do we measure this violence in our communities? And what we did is we put those data sets together and we put them in one app mapping application where you can check out all of the incidents that have happened from 2015, 2020. You can read about them. And then what we're doing next is putting additional demographic data underneath it, so that we can start to identify the neighborhoods and the areas where these incidents happen with more high frequency and see if they have some characteristics. And our initial findings from 2013 to 2015, we found that, you know, for every $10,000 to $12,000 a neighborhood went up in median household income, there was a 7 to 10% less likely chance that a fatal encounter with law enforcement occurred in that neighborhood. So even just that, that, you know, that was a very kind of back of the napkin statistical analysis, but it was real quick and dirty. And we saw, hey, look, we know these things are important, how much people make, how much poverty there is in the area, how much the police are surveying the neighborhood because of the perceived crime or whatever it might be. And so we started to uncover some of those things.
Man, that's powerful stuff, man. And I think, you know, I hope as this work moves forward, man, that it's, you know, you continue to share this with the public and the message gets out to folks across the country and across the world to understand that this work is important, that it needs to take place, and that you all are doing it and bringing this to the forefront for us to be able to utilize it to neutralize those who may be opposed to the full liberation of all of us, right? Like, to, so we can live a happy, you know, high quality of life, no matter where we're from, no matter what zip code or area code we live in, that we can all be guaranteed that we will be protected by those who are charged with protecting and serving us. And then also that, you know, it shines that light, like what you said, on income disparity and the importance of income and education disparity and how that needs to be decimated in our lifetime. Like, we need to, that needs to be extremely improved, and money and resources and talent and everything else needs to go to those areas to ensure that they have the quality of life that everyone expects. And so, yeah, man, this work, you know, on the mental health side too, just really quickly, is when you are going through that, man, what were some of the things that you did to kind of ensure that you, or, you know, that you kind of maintained your peace, man? Because look, I know you got a lot of stuff going on, bro. You know, you're a real estate developer, you're in the community, you're doing things. Did you kind of focus on other parts of your portfolio and stuff to kind of find some relief from this type of heavy work? Because it's important, but you got to make sure you're taking care of you too.
Definitely. I think I'm still working on that balance part. I'll be all the way honest. I'm still working on that balance part because I think for me, whenever, again, this is from my kind of pessimistic organizer standpoint, where I'm kind of like, I know it's going to happen again. I know it's happening today. I know it's going to happen tomorrow. And every time I see another one come across my newsfeed or come across, you know, the public, whenever the public decides to pay attention, you know, I've already been paying attention. I'm looking at that data. And whenever that happens, it just makes, it fuels the fire more, man. I'll be in the lab just looking, three screens in front of me, trying to do this, clean this data, map this data, trying to figure out, run this regression, whatever it is, because I think it's really a fuel to the fire, because the less this information is out there about how rampant this is in our communities and how innocent people have died at the hands of police, if that data and that information isn't out there, then the narrative never changes, then the behavior never changes. And so for me, it's about putting that data out there, putting that narrative out there, and having those conversations with folks so that maybe we can get closer to that behavior changing and that systemic oppression changing.
Man, well, you know, I'm with you all the way, man. I can't see, can't wait until I see this work, you know, continue to be at the forefront of what folks are talking about, especially in urban planning programs and in urban planning spaces across the country. We need to be teaching this in our schools. This is stuff that needs to be learned and folks need to be educated about, because they're going to be inheriting this world, right? And the work that you're doing is providing them a foundation from which to make great decisions from, right? Like, and this is the work that all, I think, I hope a lot of urban planners and urbanists and architects and others aspire to do for their community, is to leave it a better place, but then provide the tools for those folks who come behind us to continue to improve, you know, this world, right? And I think, you know, one of your favorite rappers, you know, one of the folks that you love, like Tupac, man, he said something, and I think it was on To Pimp a Butterfly, or I can't remember where I heard it, but it was like, he's like, I might not be the person that makes the change, but I want to spark the mind. I'm definitely going to spark the mind that inspires that change. And so I think this is what your work and the work that you and Harley have done is definitely doing that for a lot of urban planners across the country.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that a ton. And yeah, I know that interview you're talking about, you know, I may not be the one to change the world, but I will spark the change that will, I will spark the brain that will change the world. And, you know, that's how we all got to be. We got to be that hope and that beacon for others. And I think, you know, to answer your question, because I know it was a personal one, I think when I was going building this data set and working on this, you know, the fuel is there. There's also some kind of, you know, there's an anger there, like, man, I can't believe this happened. And that use that as fuel, but that's not what I've learned as an organizer. That's not a sustainable fuel source. And it's important to also do it out of love. And I think for me, when I'm doing this work, it's out of love. And that's what keeps me going. Like, I know people on that list. I've done research and I've seen the house and I know the homie and I know his dad and I know family members and went to the funeral. Like, you know, I know people who are on that list. And so I can only imagine the thousands of other people who had people that they knew who were on those lists of people who had been killed by police and were, you know, just treated without rights or without human dignity. And for me, you know, that tears down a community, that tears down people. And so what we need to do as organizers is lift people back up. And we can only do that out of love. And in giving that love in our work, in our words, in our presence and how we show up, that's really what kind of continues to fuel me.
Man, that's a beautiful message, man. And I think it's worth repeating the thing that gets a lot of folks going is like that anger and the frustration that we all feel. But what sustains us is the love for the culture and the love for our people and the love that we bring to this work that we do, man. And so I fully acknowledge what you've been up to, man. And I just want to say, man, kudos to you and congratulations on all the things, the great things coming your way, you know, top 100 tech innovators, you know what I mean? Like Frank is really out here making things happen, bro. And I, you know, before we wrap up, you know, we always, you know, at the end of the shows, man, you know, we name our episodes after songs that we love, you know, from the hip hop culture. And that's what we represent here. When we're talking about the culture, we're talking about, yes, the hip hop culture, black and brown culture across the world, urban cities, like all of these things where we come from, basically, right? We bring that to the forefront of the world. And, you know, as an urban planner, when you're out here and you're committed in the way that you are, man, you know, for me, there's always songs to grind to. Like, so, you know, when you're out here and you're doing this work, man, what are some of the songs, like the top three songs or five songs, if you got five, you know, that you grind to when you're out here doing this type of work and that sustain you and motivate you as you take on this heavy work?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of my real sources is Tupac. I've mentioned Tupac before again, and you hear Tupac's songs, you know, a lot of times the ones that he's talking about changing the community, impacting the community, it is out of that love, out of that that space. I think for me, though, one of my favorite Tupac songs is Panther Power. That's a great song. You know, Lady Liberty's a hypocrite. She lied to me, didn't give me anything but inequality and slavery.
Sheesh.
Heavy. It's truth, man.
It's true, man. It's true.
And I love listening to that kind of work because, again, that's the fuel. You know, he's speaking truth. And, you know, one of my other favorite Tupac quotes is said, you know, people can't fight for their freedom if they're fighting for their lives. And I think that's where, I know I'm derailing a little bit, but that's where, like.
That's on point.
I think, you know, when he says people can't fight for their freedoms if they're fighting for their lives, I look at Flint. I look at, you know, neighborhood in South Central where folks are getting harassed. But look at Chicago and the gun violence. I look at the COVID pandemic. And, you know, I want to end on a note of hope and opportunity, but I also need us to recognize, you know, where we're at. And brown and black people have been affected by the pandemic more. Brown and black people have lost their jobs more. Brown and black people do get assaulted by the police more. And so if we take a look at that perspective and we come to the table with that, we got to recognize that we got a lot of work to do to try to dig ourselves out and try to save ourselves. Because another, to link it to, one of my other favorite artists is Prince. And you probably know, you see me dancing in the streets and in the hallways to Prince.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
4 o'clock in the morning dancing to Prince.
Man, we love Prince out here. He get love on these streets, man.
And like he says, you know, He says, nothing else is true. The only one that can save you is you. And that's true. And we got to put our hat on and buckle up and try to take on this world and try to, in that moment, try to support other people and teach them how to work for themselves and bring each other up. So I really like music that is, you know, like on that Pac side where it's like angry and like, man, we're going to change this. We're going to tear this thing down. And then you got to balance it out with some Prince, like everything is love and we good, man. We're going to give back love to everybody and everybody's happy. We dancing in the streets and all that. And then, you know, I think one of my favorite artists who's a grinder is Currency. Currency is a big influence on me because he's a businessman. And I think that's why I really like Currency. Currency is a businessman who is somebody who has built his own empire and has done it his way. And, you know, we've been told, hey, you got to do it this way. You got to do it that way. He's like, nah, I'm going to do it this way and I'm going to get it. And so that's very much kind of my motto.
Hey, man, and he maintains a level of authenticity in all that he does, right? Because it's all him. And that's why I think it's so important that we lift up voices like such as yours and folks who have taken control of the narrative for themselves, for the community, for the culture, and push it forward, man. So I just want to say I appreciate having you on the show, man. This has been an awesome conversation. I know we're going to be having another one of these interviews here in the future because, listen, man, there's so much that you're doing now, and I'm only anticipating, you know, what you're going to be working on next. But, brother, as we go into this work in earnest, man, like, you know, we continue to take care of yourself because we need folks like you out here in the field as long as possible and empowering other people. And so having these voices are extremely important. So I appreciate you, and thank you for being on the Streets of Planning, man.
Hey, I appreciate being here. And I say, you know, much love to the people, all the power to all the people, all the time. We must fight for our freedom. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Oh, man. Yes, sir. Let's make it happen, man. And so listen, for those of you out there, you listening, show notes, we'll have Frank's social media. You want to give him your Twitter, you know, your IG, whatever, man. If you're out there, let the folks know so they can follow you. You know, and Romo GIS, we're going to include the links in the show notes, but you want to shout that out right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the company is Romo GIS. That's R-O-M-O-G-I-S. And you can find me on Twitter at Romo GIS, at Instagram at Frank Romo, Frank_Romo. And also, if you are in the Detroit area, the Detroit Developers Group, that is my organization as well. Organization that does work in the community here, renovating and working on homes. And you know, find me, come ask questions, support your local people. And if you have any questions, come to me and we can work together, coach you up, and let's deploy folks in the community and let's change this thing one community at a time, man.
Without question, man. So, you know, as always, man, I'm going to see you in the field, man. We're going to be continuing to be out here making this stuff happen. And salute to all the folks, man, that we got love for and we respect, man, in this field. And we look forward to working with you and working with each other to make sure that we are creating positive change in our community and our neighborhoods and our cities all across the world, man. So to everybody, Streets of Planet family, you know, anytime, anywhere, any place, the Streets of Planet.
Well, tell him I say fuck.